and welcome to CMU Booked, Carnegie Mellon's official book podcast, where we actually read
and finish the books. Hi, I'm Sam.
And I'm Hannah. And today we are discussing The Awakening by Kate Chopin.
Kate
Chopin.
Chopin. Oh, instead of cultural consumption today, we're going to do Album of the Week. Switch it up.
So I have been waiting patiently for the new Marina album.
Ooh.
A Princess of Power coming out soon. Wish I knew the date. Don't know it. But Cantissimo, it's been tickling my ears as of recent.
Love it.
And I need the full album to come out. Tell me, what's been tickling your ears, Hannah?
Well, you know what? I think I have two albums.
Do tell.
I think I have two albums. I have been listening to Sweetener by Ariana Grande.
Okay.
Because Dylan played Get Well Soon, and I've now just been listening to it. Otherwise, I've been listening to, you guessed it, Lemonade. Brave enough to bear the children, then get back to business. That is feminism. Anyway.
So basically, we're super excited. It's a feminist week.
Yes. Women only.
Yeah. So basically, let's jump into it.
Let's freaking go, gang.
So Hannah, like this book, tell me everything, initial thoughts, go for it.
Well, I have been so eager to read this book. Okay. Since last semester, a girl in a master's student in one of my classes did her, I was in a contemporary, the American novel was the class. And she wrote about like early feminist novels. And she talked a lot about The Awakening. She talked about The Nightingale. And we talked a lot about like Mrs. Dalloway, which I mentioned on our last episode. And she was just, she talked so much about The Awakening. And I was just like enchanted with the way that it sounded. First of all, because I love Southern Gothicism. I don't like Southern politics. Let's get one thing straight. It's just so deep in history and stuff. And so that was the first thing. First thought, I was just like, wow, this is so in Louisiana. This is such like a like Creole, like American nobility, like so, just so visceral, so yum, to put it simply. How about you, babe? First thoughts.
So true. I was honestly a huge fan. I mean, it's hard coming off of last week with Giovanni's Room.
Yeah.
Such a great book. But this, The Awakening, did not disappoint. He loves you, poor fool. Incredible line. Hey, it stuck with me. Hey. No, I was genuinely obsessed. I think I wrote down somewhere. I was like, this is no shade to Emma, because I also loved Emma.
Yeah.
Another episode we did. If Emma took a stance. That's what this book would be. You can read this book today and be like, still freaking applicable.
So applicable.
Yeah.
Very. But we're talking about Emma, and I know in that episode we talked a lot about letters, those sort of like that sort of social building that we get. We see what they observe. We see how deeply they observe everything. And this book transformed that for me. There's like the way that they describe her manner of speech was brilliant. Just the ways in which, like, your posture, how you appear to these people is so hyper-fixated on. It made me think, like, now are we less observant? Am I a less observant person just because I don't have to be? Because me as a woman, like, I'm just thinking about, I'm like, why? And this is personal, too. I'm just sort of like, I don't care. Like, I wear athleisure every day. Like, I'm not particularly thinking about how, like, I look all of the time. But I have, like, the independence to do that. You know, like, how privileged am I that I get to think about, like, what I study and, like, all of these big existential things when, like, 80% of these women's lives and Edna, our protagonist's lives, just spent hyper-fixating on these very minute social, you know, microaggressions and little things like that that just get talked about. Oh, I don't want to do this little thing because it might offend our hostess, and I wouldn't want to keep you for X amount of time because it'll offend somebody. And it's like, God, I don't think about any of that. You know, I'll Irish goodbye without a second thought. But I'm so privileged to be able to do that, you know? That was really big for me. And I think that what we were talking about, those sort of like social things in Emma, because this was written more closely to now,
right.
I think it's a more tangible notion to digest.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that what you're really like touching on already is like these women, this specific woman, Edna, she is controlling what she can control when she can control it.
Yes.
And I think that that's really interesting in that she does things that are a little bit more like aggressive to me. She's mm-hmm. like throwing glass at the fireplace, like she's ripping shit up. I love that about her. But I also, what you're talking about made me specifically think of this like scene in the book where Edna's husband, basically Edna goes away on like a Tuesday afternoon is I think
yes.
what it is. And Tuesday afternoons are supposed to be the day where any visitors can come over essentially and talk to Edna and be like hosted by them.
Yes.
And that's one of her like big roles in life is to host people because mm-hmm. like what else can she do as a woman at this time? And she decides on this Tuesday that she's just going to like leave and walk around and like meander. And that was such a big problem because as a woman, what she needs to do is make other people feel comfortable and be of value to other people and useful in this like specific time slot set out. But I guess just what I'm thinking of is the fact that like she, like Emma, is trying to find like control and happiness and like find these minute gestures in so many people around her. And like the only way that she can kind of like rid herself of that burden is like literally leaving, removing herself from the situation day of and being like, and that's one of her things mm-hmm. that she loves like walking around.
Yeah.
Because that's like when she's not being perceived because she knows that other people are perceiving her in the same way that she's perceiving them.
Like when he says to her, "Why, my dear, I should think you'd understand by this time that people don't do such things," when she goes out mm-hmm. on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to keep up with the procession and you can't afford to snub Mrs. Belthrop. They can afford.
Oh, yeah.
They can afford to snub these people.
But if he doesn't tell her that they can't afford that, then he doesn't have any power over her.
Definitely. What did you make of when her father comes to visit and the father gives... was it Léonce is how you would
yes,
say
her husband.
Name? Yeah, Mr. Pontellier, Edna's husband. The father comes to visit and he's essentially like, "You're losing control of, you know, your wife. Like she's sort of wild. She doesn't want to come to her sister's wedding," which we must get on that
right.
because that was my favorite line of the book. I called my mom this is like my mom's favorite book, to read out a line to her because I thought it was so funny. But he's like, you know, "You got to keep a handle on your wife, like be stern with her. That's the only way to keep control of your women." And even Mr. Pontellier is like, "I don't really know about that." It's like the line is like, Mr. Pontellier had some reservations that, you know, the early demise of Edna's mother had been a product of this sort of brute mentality. So we really get this very, incremental sort of generational changes, you know, where Edna's parents, right, her mom couldn't handle her father, but you know, Léonce is a little more lenient mm-hmm. with Edna than maybe her father was with her mother. And obviously now we know that novels later, we have this sort of narrative being recreative. There's more adventure, there's more risk being taken, but this is sort of an early version of that. And I just thought it was interesting seeing how that freedom and that like, sort of agency is expanded even through generations of mother to daughter. That was very interesting. What kind of man is her husband? What kind of man is Mr. Pontellier? What do we make of him? Like he likes his possessions is what we get right off the bat. But what do you make of him?
Yeah, that is a really interesting question because for me, I actually cared like so little about all of the men in this story that I like am thinking about him now. And to me, he's somebody that just is so like, I don't want to, he's so superfluous. Like he just like is so on the surface about like everything that he wants everybody in town to like not he doesn't want to be embarrassed when his wife is like moving away, basically divorcing him, you know?
Yeah.
He is only really concerned with the fact that people are going to walk by and be like, what's going on with their house? So he like sends people to go clean the house and renovate it because he wants to save face.
Yeah.
And to me, that's all he is just like a face. He's very on the surface, very much like, he's not actually concerned, not once when Edna is, you know, acting different, when she's awakened, does he say like, I'm afraid she doesn't love me anymore. Like, that's never one of his concerns. His concerns is like, she's acting crazy and I'm afraid that like my friends, she's going to treat my friends in a way that will make them view me differently,
yeah.
You know? And so I think that is like, it was never a question of love with them. Even Edna at some point is like talking about betraying someone. And she's like, by the way, I'm not talking about my husband. I'm talking about Robert.
Yeah.
So that's what I think. But definitely. Tell me.
No, I completely agree. I think, and I'm going to say as an addition to this, not, you know, like, and in spite of all of this, you know, like this novel, he's not a bad guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's not a bad guy, you know?
Totally.
I never thought that we were supposed to particularly like harbor any like true resentment towards him. Sure, he's like a, you know, he's sort of boring and he's very on the surface, but they're all sort of on the surface, you get a sense. Even like Mademoiselle Ratignolle, I'm so sorry, I'm going to butcher how to say this.
So
like,
real. I was nervous.
even Adele, her closest friend, is, you know, she's a bit vain. She's a bit, you know, she's a bit on the surface. Madame Rice is a little different.
Yeah.
And she is an outcast and she's totally separate from everyone. They respect her for her talents, but not for her personality. Whereas with the other women, their talents are an addition, but their, you know, likableness is sort of where that lies. And I think his, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a nice guy, you know, in this society. It matters if you have money and if you support, if it looks like you support your family, you know. And we're not supposed to resent him for that, I think. I think we resent the society more and how he has that independence and the ability to exert and save face, where she just doesn't have that ability, you know.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what she runs away from at the end and just can't handle, I think. But it's this line of Mr. Pontellier was very fond of walking around his house, examining its various appointments and details to see that nothing was amiss. He greatly valued his possessions, chiefly because they were his, and derived genuine pleasure from contemplating a painting, a statuette, a rare lace curtain, after he had bought it and placed it among his household goods. And I think the idea that things, materialism, is very important is a knock on this society and the culture that has been built, one that is very French, one that is very colonial, one that is very French, one that is a product of the antebellum period. And I think that we're seeing the remnants of this, and the uncomfortability of seeing it is the commentary. It's not that we're supposed to resent these people. We resent your life and the reality that this is the America that we're coming from, at least for me. And I think that that was her purpose in, you know, representing Mr. Pontellier as this sort of so, yeah, superfluous man.
Yeah, I'm like...
Like, I know we're fine. Like, yeah. He's like, it's hard because like it's not, I just don't even believe he's all there.
No,
you know?
Genuinely.
Like, I don't believe he's all there, but he still, his wife is a possession, just like the rest of this.
Exactly, know? Where I was going to go next. With all of the, he loves looking on his shelf at the things that he owns. I even think, this isn't a crazy take, I think they essentially spell out that he says like, you are a thing that I own,
yeah,
and therefore you need to act accordingly, and is,
yeah,
irritated when she doesn't. And so he goes to like the only place that he can think of to go to, which is the doctor.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting, because to me, I was kind of thinking crazy. I was thinking about the fact that like, if you got a refrigerator and it was broken, you would call the refrigerator company and be like, my fridge is broken. But when your wife is broken, what can you do other than call the doctor who like helped give birth to her?
Yep.
He's like going to factory reset and being like, what is up with her?
Oh my God.
Which I was just like, you know what? What else can you do? You're a guy. You're a product of this time. But I thought it was really interesting that he goes to other men for advice on women because he trusts women so little that he can't even just be like, what's up? Tell it to me straight.
Yeah.
But I was dying to know what you thought of some of those scenes with, like, the doctor, where he's like, oh, where the doctor's giving him advice.
I just think, again, like, it's so much more complicated. No one's all bad. No one's all good. Yeah. It's so amazing. Yeah. So beautifully written. The doctor is one of my favorite characters. And I thought that the scene in which he is literally like, your wife isn't crazy. Mm-hmm. She's just changing. And like, I like that his knee-jerk instinct is to ask what Mr. Pontellier did to her. Mm-hmm. He's like, what did you do to her? Because she sees sort of despondent when he sees her at one point. But no, I thought that it was very interesting. And you get the sense that, well, first of all, you get the sense that the doctor is more of a psychologist than an actual doctor, mm-hmm. first of all. And second of all, you get the idea that, like, he is a little disenchanted with the society. When he leaves her party and he's just like, I cannot... We never hear what troubles him. But when he then, later on in the novel, we get the idea that, like, he knows that Edna has gained too much consciousness for her own good in this society. Yeah, I just got more of a psychological take from him. And, like, I don't know. What did you think?
No, exactly. I thought that was so interesting. Because from his perspective, what can you do? Like, it's better to just be, like, unaware and unassuming and just let life pass you by, because there's no way that Edna can really move up in the ranks.
Yeah.
And so for him to have to sit by and watch this person that he obviously, like, cares about enough,
yes,
to kind of have that awakening.
Yeah.
And realize that, like, okay, well, you know, she even says, like, I can't go back, you know? Yeah. There's nothing that she can do anymore. Like, she's too far gone.
Yeah.
And at that point, she just has to, like, make the changes in her life that are going to allow her to live her life to the fullest after she's had this realization that seemingly nobody else has had, except for her friend, Madame Rice.
Yeah.
Who she even considers, like, moving in with, because she doesn't know where else to go because nobody else really gets it.
Yeah. And yeah. This is the line that I was referencing, which I think relates to what you're saying as well. The doctor, you know, doubled his old-fashioned cloak across his breast. He's getting up to leave. And it says, he was growing old and beginning to need rest and an imperturbed spirit. He did not want the secrets of other lives thrust upon him. I hope it isn't a Robin, he muttered to himself as he walked. I hope to heaven.
Yeah.
He's just a little more aware, and he can't even talk about it because of this suppression, this just, like, potent silence that hangs in the air. God, this tension of the fact that he knows she's having an emotional affair, probably a physical affair, mm-hmm. and he knows that that's why she's probably a light tear and her husband's freaking out. And we get this external reaction. We never really get the internal dialogue of him. And I think that silence is so, yeah, is integrated within this novel, even within our references to the Black people mm-hmm. that they have working in their homes. Mm-hmm. You know, they say, like, the Black girl who they order around and that Edna orders around and things like that. And I'm, again, like, I think a lot about, like, Southern Gothicism and how, you know, people are rendered, what I was saying in the last episode, people rendered in a past tense and are thereby sort of erased by this American history. And it's like, I wonder what the authorial intent of having these, you know, specifically having these Black children waiting on these rich Creole people. Mm-hmm. It's like, was it just to be as authentic? Like, this is just her life. Mm-hmm. Am I supposed to be uncomfortable? Because I am.
Yep.
Because I am, just as uncomfortable I am hearing that, you know, he didn't want the secrets of other lives thrust upon him. I think, like, that silence, maybe if it wasn't even intentional, what you're saying, how topical this is even today.
Yeah.
I think, like, this book is all right. We're awakened to all of these sort of uncomfortable realities of how systemic sort of displacement of other people are. Pretty hard, pretty uncomfortable at times.
On that, I want to talk about the fact that there is a lot of story that's kind of happening in the background of this story. For example, when Robert, her, like, the love of her life, the guy that she's, basically having an emotional, physical affair with. She is obsessed. He goes to Mexico and has presumably many love encounters, whatever we're going to call it, with like Mexican women, anybody that was there.
The women of Veracruz.
Right.
Sorry, there was one line in this book where they were like, oh, those Veracruz hotties. And I was like, what? And I was just like, what are we saying?
Wait, where are we?
Yeah. I was like, okay. You were saying.
No. But basically, he comes back and he has these little like trinkets with him that, it, what was it? It was a cigar holder, I think, that was embroidered. And,
He's changed.
He's changed. He likes other women. Girl, he wasn't yours to begin with. Like,
you weren't mine to lose.
I mean, a large part of that kind of situation was the fact that Edna did not see anybody but herself and her close, rich, white friends as competition for this man, Robert. So when he comes back, she is like, deeply confused and offended that he would even like go to Mexico and obviously have these affairs. And so I think that I am uncomfortable with the position that Edna is in, and I think that we're supposed to be. I think that it's really interesting that we as the reader are seeing her have these realizations that like it's not, the world isn't just her rich white friends.
Yeah.
I mean,
she's like, I can get laid. She's like, I can fully get laid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. That is such like, well, it's deductive, but it's also like,
I mean,
it's true.
Is it true? This is like true.
I have a burning question for you.
Please ask.
Just because you just said something, and I was going to say, if Robert had stayed, would she have been happy, do you think?
No. No. She absolutely would not have been happy. Here's the thing, is that Robert was the source of her awakening. Sort of. I think that's true. I think that it did take a man in order to awaken her. And, like, whatever, that happened. And I think that, in a sense, like, it's basically, like, Robert saved her life and now she's, like, forever indebted to him. And she's, like, so that, like, now, like, you know, someone saves your life and you're, like, I'm in love with them now. I think that that's what happened. I'm thinking about the episode of iCarly where, like, Freddie pushes her out of the way, pushes Carly out of the way of, like, the taco truck.
Yes,
and then Carly's like, I'm in love with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, I'm making crazy references.
No. That's so right. No, because, you know, people who have experienced trauma together stay together, but it's not good.
Yep. No, they're absolutely, like, in a really
that's like a crazy way to say that sentence. I'm just literally that's how I got that from the end of Speed. You know the movie Speed? Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock.
Yes, I've seen Speed.
Okay, great. Because at the end they're like, you know, relationships are doomed if they, you know, begin with something really crazy happening. And then they break up in the next movie. And so it's like, oh, okay, so you were right.
Okay.
No, so Sandra Bullock is on a boat this time, and if it's going too fast,
oh no,
they
I'm
gotta
scared.
Stop. I'm shit you not.
I'm scared.
I shit you not. That is Speed too.
Basically, they're like trauma bonded in like a really weird way, or at least she's trauma bonded to him.
Because
as we see, he is not really all that. Like he left. Of course, he left because he was like, I like her. Like I need to go. But I don't think it was as big of a thing for him. Whatsoever.
Selfish.
Yeah.
Selfish. Yeah. Oh, you have the privilege to go to Mexico at the drop of a hat, decide one afternoon, a few hours into the day.
Yep.
Sorry, that sounded aggressive only because I was so like. Yes, and everyone in society was like, what the hell are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they welcome him back with open arms.
Guess well, yes,
who,
they did.
Guess who doesn't get welcomed back with open arms because she kills herself? Edna.
And I need to ask you about that.
Definitely something to be said about, like, the religious aspect of this and the religious quality of... the fact that her awakening sort of goes hand in hand with subtle notions of her being sort of atheistic, or not atheistic, but not exactly this Christian ideal that her dad sort of and her sister Margaret adhere to. Right, they're very piety over everything, and you know, rigor, and this very Protestant ideal. Or I mean, they're Creole, so what are they? They're Southern Baptist, I would presume.
That would
I think a Presbyterian. So there you go. Very Southern roots, you know, what is it? fire and brimstone sort of ideology. And I think that, right, this idea of her sort of being born again through her first swim, oh man, that was a lot. I mean, like, it's like it's a Chekhov's gun that I just did not know how to deal with. And I mean, I know how this ends just because my mom spoiled it for me as a child, but I literally wrote down, like, Chekhov's gun, holy wow, when she first learns to swim and, like, lets go. And I think it's very powerful that at the end she immerses herself, goes underwater, she's born again, and we sort of see her life flashing before her eyes. I didn't really read into it any more than that, I'm going to be totally honest, because I didn't think it meant anything more to her than that, due to the fact that she sort of has this detachment from religion as opposed to her youth.
I'm thinking about the fact that we just watched recently-ish a film for our sci-fi class. I think I'm thinking of the right one, Deluge.
Yeah.
Where she swims
polygamy.
Out. Yeah, yes. The polygamy one.
I was thinking of that as well, yeah.
So there's this film we watched, Deluge, 1933, sci-fi film where...
I made a joke about The Awakening in that class, actually.
And I did
when
not
we
watched watch
Deluge. Because she swims out into the ocean.
To kill herself. So it's the exact same ending, and to me, I was so I had watched Deluge before I had read The Awakening, and I actually did not know how this ended. Shout out me in the last episode laughing along, not knowing how in fact it ended.
Yeah, Simone said it and you were laughing. I was like, oh my god,
she has no idea.
No, it's great.
No, it's so great not knowing how things end.
I love it.
But I guess my question is, like, is the only way to escape a patriarchal society to kill yourself? Like, is that what we should take away from this, or is it a little bit more nuanced than that?
Right, like, is it a sacrifice? Or is she given up? Or is it independence?
Oh, yeah.
It says here, this is what I wrote down as the Chekhov's gun line. Mm-hmm. This is when she first learns to swim. A quick vision of death smote her soul, and for a second of time appalled and enfeebled her senses. But by an effort, she rallied her staggering faculties and managed to regain the land. I thought I should have perished out there alone. This is what society has done to her.
Yeah.
She's beaten down into oblivion to a point where she thinks this is what her future is.
And there was another Chekhov's gun that I did not clock on the first read through. There is a quote where one of her friends, I actually cannot remember, who was talking about a bird.
You know this.
Yeah. Let me read through this. So basically, do you remember who said it?
I don't. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Basically, someone is talking to Edna and they say, "The bird that would soar above the level plain of tradition and prejudice must have strong wings. It is a sad spectacle to see the weaklings bruised, exhausted, fluttering back to earth."
To be an artist, you must be daring and willing to make risks.
Yep.
That is what Madame Rice tells her. Mm-hmm. I think we're not supposed to condemn. We're not supposed to think that she is weak for doing this or selfish. That is just so far off. Like, you know, and I know that you feel this way, but I feel like it is her only act of autonomy. It's her only act of autonomy. And I do think that it's sort of like this sacrifice for, I mean, it's hard to say, but it's her exerting independence and her sacrificing herself for maybe the realization for others. Who knows? But I do think that her suicide is, you know, more, it goes sort of in tandem with the idea that she's not a mother woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not it's like, that's not bad. We're not supposed to, you know, the whole reason why, you know, people feel driven to these things is because you condemn, you know, like, you beat them down, 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 down.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the entire book, I didn't really see the main character as somebody who would be able to break out of a system. When Madame Rice is like, you need to be courageous in order to be an artist, I was like, that's not our girl. You know what I mean? She's probably pretty talented.
Yeah.
The thing that she's passionate about, which is like painting, drawing, but it never occurs to like the reader, at least me, that she's going to be this like strong-willed, courageous artist. And Madame Rice sees that too. So when you get to the end and she has like the courage to kill herself.
She has that soul. She yeah. has the soul of an artist. I was literally wrote that down.
Yeah.
I was literally going to ask you, does Edna have the soul yeah. of an artist? So
you find out.
I totally agree.
You find out. Yes, she does. You know, and it's in that action that you like leave being like, wait, you know what? Maybe me personally, as I read, maybe I was misjudging her. Maybe I didn't see that she had that soul because I saw so much of what she like lacked. I was like, well, when I'm thinking about Edna, as I was first reading this, I was like, she's the kind of person, she doesn't want to be a mother per se. She doesn't want to be a wife, but I wasn't thinking about what she does want to be.
But that, yeah.
Yeah.
And it dumb, and that sort of like very biological, you know, view of me as a woman, I am a wife, but I am a wife so I can be a mother.
Yeah.
And then that is my purpose for the rest of my life. And motherdom is the purpose of the rest of my life, right? She doesn't have that motherly instinct. And by the end, she has come to terms with that. And some women don't want to be mothers.
Yeah.
And like, I'm sorry that she had to realize that. She's 20 freaking nine, dude. Yeah. She's 29.
Give her a break.
That's when my mom had me, you know? She's already had two kids. How tragic. And so, yeah, like as Dylan said, like she is surrendering to oneself. She is surrendering to herself. She is giving herself over to her spirit and her being, her authentic self, which is this independent, free spirit, you know? Like, imagine if Edna had been able to travel. Like, where would she have gone? What music would she have exposed herself to?
Speaking of music. What song? As we go over, this is the most tragic story. So what song do you think it is, by the way?
Dude.
Tell me.
Wide Open Spaces by the Chicks.
Sing it for me.
She needs wide open spaces. Wait, no, there's one line. I'm sorry. I only sang the one line, but it's like her, as she drives out her house, her dad yells, check the oil. Anyway. It's just all about like you needing space. Yeah. You need space to grow up, and it's all about the song is just so fire. And it's also like the Chicks.
Yep.
They make country music and they rock.
Hey, I'm a fan.
Yeah. Love them. How about you? Hit me. Song association.
Southern Nights. I'm doing
Glenn Campbell.
Yeah.
Is Glenn Campbell in the room with us?
Shout out. Hey, be on the pod.
I think he's
dead. Yeah, he's probably dead. This song was released in 1977.
I feel like we're wrapping things up. Yep. Any final thoughts on this novel?
So basically, I really freaking loved it. I pulled out so many quotes that I was kind of, in a sense, obsessed with, I would have to say. It just, like, read beautifully.
So beautifully.
It read so, so beautifully. And I would love to find, like, one more quote yeah. that I just, like,
need yeah, give me read. Your favorite quote. I feel like that's a perfect way yeah. for us to leave off our listeners with their ears tickled.
The way that my ears were tickled by yes. Contissimo.
I also said that this was a... I called this the tale of a rogue people pleaser.
This is a quote from a random page on the random thing that I'm reading from.
Perfect.
It was not that she dwelt upon details of their acquaintance or recalled in any special or peculiar way his personality. It was his being, his existence, which dominated her thought, fading sometimes as if it would melt into the mist of the forgotten, reviving again with an intensity which filled her with an incomprehensible longing.
Like, she is so down bad.
Yeah.
I felt so bad for her.
I know. Because, like, it's not even the subject matter of this. It's just how beautifully
I know.
The quote reads.
You just, and it's so, the prose is so understated, but it's so real.
Yeah.
It's also colloquial. Like, they call things capital. They call things capital and other stuff. So, like, that colloquial or even, like, Creole sort of slang.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed.
Please read me your favorite quote.
Mine is a more cheerful one. This made me laugh. This is the one I said my mom likes.
Yeah.
Or I like and called my mom. So, it basically, Mr. Pontellier goes to visit the doctor, and he's like, well, isn't Edna's sister getting married? If she's so, like, all over the place, why don't you go tell her to go, like, go spend some time with her sister who's getting married? And Mr. Pontellier says, that's what I want her to do. She won't go to the marriage. She says a wedding is one of the most lamentable spectacles on earth. Nice thing for a woman to say to her husband. Savage.
I also highlighted that.
Savage. She is a savage. Like, she's so funny. That line is hilarious. One of the most lamentable. Also, shout out Emma, literally Mr. Woodhouse.
No.
Oh, what a travesty. Isabella's marriage to Mr. So
good. I also highlighted that. Like, I have to say, like, she's dabbing on the haters.
Yes.
Like, in a very serious way.
She said the institution of marriage is archaic, period.
Speak on it.
Yes.
Like, yes.
This is my favorite book that we've read so far. I'm going to say that.
Love that for you.
I'm going to say that. Crazy thing to say. Hannah has a favorite anything. She hates everything. Sorry, I don't hate everything.
No, but
I liked most of what we've read.
Can we rate it really quick?
Rate it? Oh my God, I thought you were going to be like, read it. I thought you said read it really quick.
Yeah, I actually didn't read the novel.
And I was like, Sam. What? Rate it 10 out of 10.
Rate
11
it.
Out of 10. Turn it up to 11. How about you?
I'm going to go a solid 8.75. So basically, it's really going to be hard to top Giovanni's Room for me, but I loved it.
Period.
Let's do our CMU question of the week. Hannah.
Most embarrassing CMU in class memory.
So can I tell mine really quick? I'm going to give the abridged version.
Yes.
Okay. So basically, I'm in 36200, shout out, stats class. And
I remember this. Oh my God, I was there. I was literally there. Oh my God, Sam, please tell the story.
Bad. Cannot believe she knows it instantly. I'm humiliated. So basically, I'm in the middle of like a 300 person lecture hall, and I'm the first person to finish a test. I get to the end, and basically what I do is my ankle gets caught on someone's backpack, and I'm holding the test, and I face slam to the ground,
and then my head hit the ground.
So basically, like, a missile had gone off and, like, echoed throughout the entire classroom.
I did see Sam fall. I'm going to be so real. I sat in the last row in the back, so I had a view of everything. And then later that day, Sam and I had class together.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, my God, I fell in 36200. I was like, I saw. I'm in class with you. Shout out Stephen Wittick's class where we had this conversation.
But persist. And nevertheless, she persisted.
Period.
Hannah, tell me your most embarrassing class moment.
Mine is more of an internal thing that I really just could not handle because I was so embarrassed because I said it with my full chest. It was in my recitation for Intro to Psychology freshman year. And we were talking about feng shui as like a cultural thing. And it was like, okay, like what has good versus bad feng shui? And I
what is
like, my hand went up. They called on me. And I was like, well, you know how in different cultures, you know, like people don't want their heads facing the doors when they sleep? Yeah. And the whole class was like, I don't know what that is. I've never heard of that. And I was like, oh my God. Even my TAs were like, yeah, we've never heard of that. And I was like, well, why don't I just leave then? I'll just fucking leave and you'll have no one raise their hand. Anyway, so I was really embarrassed. And the embarrassment led to anger.
Mine was so much worse.
Yours was so much worse.
Anyway.
Anyways. So, basically, remember to follow us on Instagram. Follow us on Instagram at CMU Booked. We've got some poppin' posts.
Yep. Just basically freaking reach out, ask to be on the pod, DM us.
If you want to be a guest.
Yeah, just basically do that.
We have a great time here.
Yeah. We like to have fun sometimes.
Yeah.
Not most of the time. Anyways,
catch you on our next episode.
Catch you on the flippity flop.
Bye.
Bye.